CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast. We're glad to have you along for this one as we're here to educate, inform, and occasionally even entertain. I'm Larry Jewett.
And I'm Jeff Stark, and I hope we're entertaining more than occasionally, but I know this episode's going to be a lighter one. We don't have a guest this week for you, but we're going to have fun exploring the highways and byways numismatically. And I get to talk about something that was really cool that I got to witness the other day. And we're just going to have a good old conversation and fun talking about the hobby as usual. Thank you so much for being here and giving us a chance to join you, hopefully every week. And if you haven't been here from the beginning, go back. We're now in our fifth year, I think. Is that right? Or we're starting our sixth year now, maybe. Yeah, 2018.
I don't know. I can't tell you what I did 2 weeks ago. I mean, I don't know. You were here on the ground floor. So, I mean, you understand. I mean, you should have at least, I would guess it's probably the fifth year because you never got your medal for your fifth year. So we need to look into that. We need to get some CoinWorld Podcast medals made up. And we need to, make sure that you get one complete with a ribbon because you've been the one who's been here for, I think you might have missed one episode. I think I got stuck doing one by myself. But ever since then, I've tried to figure out a way to get you to get stuck to do one by yourself. And I haven't succeeded in that, I don't think. But, idea.
This episode marks the beginning of our sixth season because our first episode dropped on April 1, 2019. So we've concluded five seasons. Now we're in season six.
April 1st. Couldn't you pick a better day?
That's what worked out. I know it's forever a mark on our legacy, if you will, but it is what it is. So, something I got to do on April 3rd, however, this year was really fun. Let me talk about that. Wayne Homran, who is the editor of the eSylum, that's kind of like Asylum, but eSylum with a hyphen in there. That's a weekly hobby news email. Wayne was in St. Louis.
Let me stop you right there. Let me stop you right there because you are the one who introduced me to Wayne's newsletter, the eSylum. There has not been a Monday morning that I haven't opened up and read what Wayne writes about. So this is my chance to say to you, the listeners, check it out. You've got to be a part of this because there's some great information in there. He didn't pay me for this. He's not going to pay me for this. But I'm telling you right now that when you can start your week off with the kind of information Wayne delivers across a myriad of subjects, you need to get involved with that. So I'm sure Jeff will tell you how you can get involved. Okay, yeah. Now it's my turn to listen.
So you mean to say that there hasn't been a Monday gone by that you have not done that? You've done it every Monday.
Yeah, that's what I mean to say. See, this is the thing. I got a feeling that that's the first boo-boo. There's going to be more. So you talk instead of me. I'm going to listen now.
Okay, so check it out. I think if you just Google eSylum with a dash, you're gonna be able to find it, and it's hosted by the Numismatic Bibliomania Society. Which, if I've ever been accused of anything, of being a numismatic bibliomaniac, certainly is appropriate. In any event,
you're one of those.
Yeah.
Okay, you know what happens if you're found guilty of this, don't you? They throw the book at you. Go ahead.
Wow, I thought all the cheesy puns were my domain. But in any event, Wayne was here in St. Louis at an event hosted by the Newman Numismatic Portal, Newman Numismatic Educational Foundation, whatever. I don't want to get that wrong. There's a couple different you know, the portal is run by the foundation. I believe the event was sponsored by the foundation. In any event, Leanna Spurrier was there. She came up from Louisville to record it for the Newman portal. And Len Augsburger, who is project coordinator for the portal, he came down from Chicago and was there. I got to see some folks from my local coin club and then a handful of other folks from various units, different, you know, organizations, wherever they came from, they were there to be present for this presentation about the life of artist J.S.G. Boggs. And I posed the question to Wayne at dinner after the lecture. Boggs was an artist. He died in 2017, but he became well known for his imagery of banknotes, and not just American banknotes. He did Australian, he did British, he did Swiss notes, but he traveled around the world drawing these notes and spending them. And the transaction was, in effect, the artwork, as you know, as much as the piece of paper that had the design on the note. He would draw a $10 note, a $500 note, whatever the case may be, and use that to purchase something, whether it was rent, whether it was a meal. The story goes that he got his first start by trading a note for coffee. He drew a dollar note and got coffee and a donut for 90 cents and even got a dime back in change in the early 80s. We've talked about Boggs on the program before. In fact, I think we interviewed Craig Whitford from the Boggs, the foundation that's run by the Boggs family. In any event, you know, Boggs treads this line of between numismatics and art. So I asked Wayne, you know, which camp has accepted him more readily, or, you know, where was he more comfortable? And also then, you know, when these artworks are put up for sale, do they belong in an art auction or a numismatic auction? And he answered the first question by saying it's really 50-50. There's pretty much, you know, there's a lot of folks who came to Boggs from the numismatic side, but there are many who came from the art side, and they liked being challenged philosophically, conceptually, the idea of what constitutes money. Because as it is now, you know, you or I, we wave our credit card, a piece of plastic, or some folks more advanced even than I wave their phone. They've got it enabled that they can just wave their phone and voila, they paid for whatever at Starbucks or the local cafe or any number of places. You know, money is not just round, shiny objects, not just flat paper objects, cotton in this case, and paper money. You know, it takes many forms, and Boggs was really at the forefront of challenging what it means to be considered money and questioning the value of money and the inherent nature of it. Boggs is credited as sort of the godfather of cryptocurrency, which I won't hold that against him. And I don't say that to be cheeky, but, you know, I very much dwell in the physical space. You know, last night at dinner, you have to wave your phone to look at the menu. I want a hard copy menu. It's hard to process on a little phone screen. I'm very much an ink stained retro on dead tree kind of guy. And so I dwell in that space when it comes to, you know, tangible investments. And I, you know, that's just me. And I know it, other people works differently, but it was very enjoyable to be present for this lecture, this discussion. There were questions after about Boggs and his life. You know, he ran afoul of the Secret Service and they confiscated a bunch of his stuff. And Boggs spent many years till the end of his life trying to get that back, and was ultimately unsuccessful. For shame that happened, when there were many other cases where he was brought before the law, different, you know, judicial ramifications, different outlets, and they looked at what he was doing and said, oh, you're obviously not counterfeiting. You know, you're telling people, you know, Boggs was very upfront. This is, I'll pay you Federal Reserve notes, real money, or you can take this piece of art that has a denomination listed on it. What do you want? And most of the time he was turned down. And I couldn't help but think, you know, there, how many times have you had that question of, if you could go back in time, hop in that time machine numismatically, where would you go? Would you go to the 1830s, I think it was, when the 1804 dollar was being created? Would you go to 1913, the U.S. Mint, and try to make your own vehicle, if you will, or 1933 in that whatever March, I think March 1933, when that window of availability was supposedly existed for the 33 double eagle, where would you go? I would want to go back to the 80s and 90s when Boggs was spending this money or trying to spend this money, and to own a piece of it that was really from a closed loop transaction. Obviously, that's, you know, there are other more valuable things to pursue, but that would have been so cool to have been able to participate in that commerce. In any event, it was a very neat lecture, very fun night. And I know at some point that presentation will be available on the numismatic portal for the many, many, many of you who were unable to attend it. There was a gentleman who came in from several states away. There was plenty of locals, but it will exist out there on the internet, theoretically for perpetuity. And it's really worth checking out. It was really enjoyable. So that's what I've been up to numismatically.
Well, I'm glad you were able to take part of that. I mean, because it's all about getting out there. And we were talking earlier, a friend of mine was talking about the importance of club meetings, and club meetings become a place where, you know, we can all get some benefit out of. Sometimes it takes us a while to realize what that benefit actually is. And when you have a special presentation like this and just the idea of learning, I remember our podcast we had talking about Boggs and some of the news items that have been out there as well since we've had that. And it's just like, this is an interesting subject. And certainly that brings to mind all of the different opportunities that you have when you go to coin shows as well. I mean, a lot of times I spend more time upstairs in the conference rooms than I do on the bourse floor at the fun show and some of the many shows. And certainly with Newman taking care of the NMP, taking care of the education upcoming at the Central States Numismatic Society event. And there will be chances for us to learn in similar environments there. And I think it's all about learning once again. I talked in the beginning about we do entertain, but the idea is we try to inform with this podcast. And any chance we get a chance to learn from experts and hear from experts and those who have done the research, well, we definitely should do that. So I'm glad you had that opportunity.
Yeah. And, you know, a friend of mine, a fellow club member, was like, oh, I bet you know all this already. And I said, well, no, actually, no, there were several aspects to it that I hadn't heard of before, wasn't tuned into. It's certainly a very famous, I won't say episode, series of episodes, you know, famous in the hobby. And but there's so much more to learn about this. I don't know how certain this is, so I'm maybe kind of cautiously stepping into it here, but supposedly the Family Foundation, the Boggs folks, are working on a catalogue raisonné, a compilation of all of Boggs' work. And one of the factors that have, you know, there are two factors that have really made this market for Boggs' work murky, and that's the paucity, the scarcity of the items. There aren't a lot of items out there to begin with, and it's hard to create a market when there's an absence of information about it. And obviously, when you sell the item and you have multiple sales over a period of time, you have a track record, and people become more confident in the market for that, then they're willing to step up and spend the money because, oh, hey, the market supports it at this level. You know, that does help the lack of sales records. And one of the you know, these items are in collector hands, and theoretically they're going to be in collector hands for a long time. We know, I think we've mentioned it before, the three D's of why items come back onto the marketplace from collectors, and that's death, divorce, and debt. And so obviously there will be folks who die, and then their estates will handle the sales of this. So a lot of these are locked up. So there's an absence of sales data, and there's an absence of items. The catalog will at least help clarify some of the unknowns as far as what items exist out there that are, you know, can be traced to Boggs, and provide more certainty as to, you know, it's just like if you buy an ancient coin now and it's only the only one known, and 6 months from now there's 100 found in a hoard, well, your value just went kaput because of the thing that was out of your control, right? When you bought that coin, you had no idea what was going to happen, that there was all these out there in a hoard. Well, a hoard of Boggs stuff could be out there waiting. And if it's in the catalog, well, then you know, okay, hey, wait a minute. You know, there are others out there. Maybe it'll take 20 years to get access to, but it's very instructive when you think about, when you hear that, and then think about that, how you can apply that to other areas of the hobby. It was super beneficial all the way around. I don't want to beat a dead Boggs, but you know, it was fun. Hopefully you check it out and go back and catch our interview, our podcast back, I don't know, a year and a half ago or something, about Boggs.
Well, I'm going to find out what episode that was while you tell us a little bit about what was going on in numismatic history, because here we are now into the month of April, and I'm sure that you've got some events that are happening there. I'm going to do my research. I'll be right back.
All right. So let's hop in the magical time machine 24 years ago, April 5th, 2000. That was when Sacagawea dollar coin designer Glenna Goodacre received her commission of $5,000 in the form of 5,000 specially produced Sacagawea dollars on burnished planchets. So the Native American dollar, the Sacagawea dollar predecessor, actually, Glenna Goodacre famously designed it using Randy L. Teton as the model. And Randy L. Teton has attended lots of coin shows to promote the design and just, you know, be an added bonus for the attendees of the show. Well, this is where some brilliant marketing came in. Goodacre took those $5,000 rather than just get a check, just something you take to the bank. She took those $5,000 and cooperated with a grading service to have them encapsulated, and I believe she even signed the grading label insert, and then those were sold at a premium above their face value and the cost of grading, because hey, there's only 5,000 available. They were on special planchets. It really was a marketing coup, and sort of the beginning of this modern era where there's different grading labels and, you know, different iterations of stuff. I mean, we see it in the world numismatic space for the new issues. There might be a reverse proof version and an ultra high relief version and a regular version. Well, this was sort of along those lines, special version of the Sacagawea dollar. With some hunting, you can find those coins, and that would make the perfect capstone to a Sacagawea dollar collection. And hey, that was in both our lifetimes, probably many of you listening, it was in your lifetime as well. April 5th, 2000.
Wow. But still, that's 24 years ago. And, you know, I hate doing that to myself, but I tend to do that a lot. And it's just like, what? That was so when? I mean, because I just like even mentioned the Sid Finch episode, that's been 20 some years ago. That's just hard for me to have, maybe even more. 40
I was going to say 39 years ago, I think. Yeah. Wasn't that in like 1985 or 86?
I'm pretty sure it was 84, 85, somewhere in that time frame. But You know, just that's what you think about here. And that's why it's so important to keep hanging on to what happens in history, because, you know, just here we are decades later and we still, you know, still can talk about that because it's still something that's numismatically important here. We keep piling on the history because it just keeps rolling right along here. We're making history every day. And this event, you know, from 20 some years ago is one that we remember by looking back at it. So are we going to go back even further? Because CoinWorld's been around 64 plus years now.
Yeah, let's random number generator says 1986. So let's go back to the April 2nd, 1986 issue for this week in CoinWorld history. And I got to say, I was surprised to see the cover story being what it is, but really in a good way. The main story, the only story on the front page of this issue of CoinWorld is headlined "Obsolete Banknotes of Midwest Reflect Pioneering Spirit." Subhead, common themes include Indians, farmers, and early transportation. So, you know, obsolete notes are a fun area, especially of interest, this story to me, because I was thwarted in bidding and winning on the Eric P. Newman paper money records regarding Missouri banknotes. So this is a fun story that includes Missouri banknotes. And the story by Jay Gurin, then I believe of CoinWorld staff, says frontier banking in Missouri and Kansas was as far removed from the staid institutions of the Northeast as fur trapping was from operating a woolen mill. Then he goes on and talks about how trappers pushing up the Missouri and Western tributaries all the way west were the ones to introduce the first currency in the area in the form of handwritten warehouse receipts for furs. Very, very fun delve into American history, Missouri history. It didn't take long after Jefferson's purchase, Louisiana purchase, for St. Louis to become the principal city. And westward traffic out of St. Louis followed the course of the Missouri River across the state to Kansas City, which soon became a river port in its own right. It's very cool just to see obsolete notes tackled in this way, exploring how the vignettes appearing on these notes highlight the you know, paddle steamers and the natives that lived in the area, and how the War of 1812 delayed the opening of St. Louis's first bank, the Bank of St. Louis, into 1816. It's a very neat feature story. Trains are all over it, too. I mean, it's just it's fun to see. It really doesn't, you know, it's not a milestone in numismatic history, but it's a reminder that there are some great topics out there worthy of exploration. And, you know, trains, there are lots of people who collect coins with trains and paper money with trains. And this is just one more way to approach it. That's what excited me because of the special connection. And hey, you know, there's the coin show in Kansas City going on earlier this week and as we speak. So to see an 1877 city warrant proof note from Kansas City with the Sidewheeler Kansas City off the, you know, a bustling river port, it's just kind of fun. That got me excited. That's what I saw from April 2nd, 1986, CoinWorld.
Well, we went into the letters page, which was only back on page 4, as a matter of fact, and a variety of topics that were there. Some praise for the U.S. Mint, an autograph collector ringing in on coins and autographs. This letter was of interest to me. It says, "Open ANA meetings. The purpose of this letter is to register my total disgust with the American Numismatic Association Board of Governors for the establishment of what you so blithely call the working session. This is just one more way of cutting membership of the ANA off from the policies or the board's policymaking activities. I am in complete agreement with the opinions and suggestions expressed in the CoinWorld editorial of March 5th. Although I am not connected with Numismatic Press, I have been a working journalist for 26 years, and I am alterably opposed to boards that want to work behind closed doors and then emerge to take a public vote. I seriously considered not renewing my 9-year-old ANA membership this year because I believe the association is devoting too much time and resources to grading coins for dealers and high buck investors and not enough time and resources to serving collectors. Believe me, if the working session is not abandoned before renewal time comes around, I will say goodbye. And that was from Glenn Ickler, and Mr. Ickler happened to be the editor of the Middlesex News, a newspaper based out of Framingham, Massachusetts. So he knows a little bit of what he was talking about there as far as the closed meetings and the information that's available from organizations for the general public. Another letter I want to get some information on here, and basically that's what the writer is asking about. Said, I would greatly appreciate the help of all Coin World readers. I am now determining the surviving quantities of all half cents minted from 1800 to 1857. If you have any half cents minted during these years, please send me a note telling me how many pieces you have of each date. Varieties will be helpful, but not necessary. If you know of any friends or relatives who have such coins, please inform them of my request. Using sophisticated computer techniques, I believe I'll be able to arrive at more accurate estimates of surviving mintages than ever before possible. From P. Nielsen, Huntington Valley, Pennsylvania. And of course, that was 1986. And I'm pretty sure we're in a little better situation now than we were then.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder if you're in a better situation when it comes to answering trivia.
Zero chance.
You've whiffed on quite a few lately, and you're standing in for the listeners, so hopefully you can represent them well with this one. Last week, I asked you, because I got to speak with Gitta from Numistax, got me thinking about the other Stacks, Stax Bowers, based in New York and California, and they've got offices all over now, and of course, they just bought out our friend Dennis Hengeveld of World Banknote Auctions. You might have seen that in the latest issue of Coin World. How long has Stax been around? When was Stax founded? We know Numistax was founded recently. Stax, a little longer ago than that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. They've been around for a long time. I mean, just the idea that, you know, they started way back when. I'm just trying to figure out way back when. It seems to me they just had an anniversary not that long ago. And trying to remember whether it was, it's not 100, not quite up to 100 yet. I think they've been around a little more than 90 years.
So let's do the math here. 2024 minus 90 would be 1934. They've been around a little longer than 90 years. That puts them at 1933. And that is the year they were founded. So I'm going to give you credit. You got it this time.
I'm not a believer in new math. I had to come up with a different way to come up with that answer rather than, you know, subtracting this from that and carrying the, you know, taking off my shoe and counting it and that type of thing. But I just remembered that late in 2023, it seemed like that they were and, you know, it should be one that you can remember easily because they were founded in 33, if I'm not mistaken. So that's, you know, the big deal about the $20 St. Gaudens and everything. So it's easy to remember. But, you know, the service that they've provided, you know, another company founded in 33. We've had the guests on for the podcast, that being Kagan's. Kagan's was founded in 1933 as well. And speaking of podcasts, I did get my research done. The episode regarding the Boggs material was episode 174. Now, I wasn't going to ask you that as a trivia question, but it was episode 174, if you're interested in finding out more information about Boggs. So,
very good. Very good.
And I'll tell you the reason why I've been whiffing on so many questions. Spring training. I was really, really, really focused on trying to make the big club, and I didn't make the big club. So now I got to stay really, really focused on trying to impress the big club so that I can make them. And now I just had my first hit. So I'm good. I mean, I'm off to a good start.
All right. Well, then here's your next chance to shine. You know, we often hear that wartime nickels were the first Philadelphia Mint coins to carry a P mint mark, but that's not true.
I know this one.
What were the first coins struck at the Philadelphia Mint to bear a P mint mark?
Thank you, Bill O'Rourke. That's all I got to say about that. I feel confident that next time we get together, I will be on the win streak.
I may or may not have borrowed the question from his Facebook.
Okay.
So I think I saw it out there and I was like, yeah, that's a good one. It's a good stumper. Although apparently not maybe for you, but we'll give you listening at home or wherever you're listening. You have until next time to do your research, see if you can come up with the answer. And that goes for you, Larry, as well.
Well, and there will be a story when I answer that question. I'll save that for next week. So,
all right. Until next week.
Happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.